Hey everybody, Raul here for Bass Musician Magazine, and today we have the extraordinary honor and pleasure of chatting with bassist, vocalist, songwriter, and so much more, Travis Book. Yay!
Okay, how's it going?
It's going great, it's going great. Travis, there's so many exciting things to talk about. You've got a lot going on right now. However, we always like to go to the past. How did you get started in music, and particularly on bass?
Well, I really lucked out. I had parents that were into music. My mom was actually in like a rock cover band that would play bars on the weekends and play weddings. So music was always around the house. And we'd go to church sometimes and sing hymns together. That really helped me learn about like singing the different parts and how to harmonize. But then there was always, you know, mom was going off and doing gigs on the weekends, and my dad played acoustic guitar and was also a huge and still is an incredible music aficionado. In fact, every time I make a record, he writes me like a 4-page review of it. And he would always like, you know, point out the John Paul Jones bass lines when we were listening to Zeppelin. But the way I got into bass, there was a group of friends that were, we had a guitar player and a drummer, and I would go to rehearsals and I would sing. And after about the third rehearsal, we realized we needed a bass player. And I asked my mom, and in her infinite wisdom, she said, if you have a bass, you'll always have a gig. And that could not have been more true for me, and that really has been sort of the story of my career, is, you know, just being available and having the gear and having wide open ears has kept me really, really busy for the last 30 years.
Nice, nice. And have you pursued formal education and training? Are you self-taught?
Very little formal education. Some one-on-one lessons with some bass players I really appreciated when I was in Nashville. But for the most part, the work that I do and the practicing that I do is a lot of real-time, gig-related, learning stuff specifically and exploring the instrument specifically around what is going to be needed of me at the gig. That's been sort of the biggest way for me to open my mind. I know that that method has also left a lot of holes in my playing, but I'm fortunately getting to a place with my age and my career where I'm okay playing to my strengths, and I don't lose a lot of sleep over my musical weaknesses.
There you go. Well, you know, I talk to so many bass players, and everybody's journey is very different. And some of the most amazing players have had, you know, they came up basically the same way you did. It was, I had a bass, and they needed a bass, and I played. And, you know, 80 years later, they're still going, and you kind of go, well, can't argue with that kind of success. And so the infamous String Dusters is a kind of progressive neo-bluegrass, I guess it would be a fair categorization of it. How did that gig come about for you?
I've been playing in string bands and bluegrass bands and living in Colorado, doing like ski bum thing and the music thing, you know, kind of riding that line, and ended up going to the bluegrass scene is great because people love to get together and play music together. And there's this huge shared lexicon of music. So once a year they get together, the International Bluegrass Music Association puts on like a, it's a little bit of like a trade show vibe now, but you know, 20 years ago, it was just like an end of the year party. And I went out there with some people I was playing with, and I met the String Dusters. I stepped off the elevator with a bass and a backpack full of beer, and one of them was coming around the corner looking for a bass player for their jam. It was really that kind of that simple, and I played music with them that night, and then a couple months later, they still were having trouble finding a bass player. They were trying to put this band together. They didn't know what it was going to be, what it was going to be called, exactly who was going to be in it, but they could not find the right bass player, so they called me and had me audition. And that was when I decided to move to Nashville to be in the String Dusters and sort of commit myself to this adventure of creating a band, and ideally a band with its own sound and its own distinctive contribution to the musical world, in the context of basically playing string instruments and what is essentially sort of an extension of the bluegrass sound that Bill Monroe kind of forged and created back in the 40s and the 50s. So I was in Nashville for a while with the String Dusters, but the Dusters have been going, it'll be 2024 will be our 19th year as a band together.
Well, and it's interesting because obviously you're doing something right because you guys have a Grammy win and some Grammy nominations. And so it's being very well accepted. And it's always kind of interesting, I think, unless you are a fan of bluegrass, the immense following that it has may go rather undetected, but it's festivals like you're mentioning, and activities. I know when we were living in the Pacific Northwest, there were bluegrass events happening all around us up there too. And you'd kind of go, well, this seems far away from Nashville or far away from the Carolinas or something, where you might go, okay, I had expected there, but it was very alive and well wherever we were going. Now, in addition to that, you have recently released, just this last October, Love and Other Strange Emotions. So you've got kind of more of a solo album yourself. Tell us a little bit about that project.
Well, it's basically a rock and roll record, which is a big departure from what I've been doing for the last 20 years, but is much closer to sort of how I started as a fan of, you know, Radiohead and U2 and Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and Jethro Tull, you know, these kind of classic rock ensembles. So in a way, it's a little bit of a return to the roots. The reason I came upon this is that I play a weekly gig here in this little town that I live in, and every week the music is different. I get together different musicians and we try different stuff. And one of the weeks I decided I was just going to play electric guitar, and we have a tremendous drummer here, Jeff Sipe, one of the best drummers on the planet. He lives just down the street. And my buddy Mike Ashworth is a great electric bass player. He plays in a band called the Steep Canyon Rangers, but we also call him the Natural. He can play anything. Killer electric guitar player, great drummer in that band, but he also plays electric bass. So we got together and I played electric guitar and played as many of my own songs as I could on electric guitar, almost as like an exercise to just sort of see what it would feel like. Mm-hmm. And by, you know, the first show was great, so 6 months later we did it again. And by the third time we did it, these fans, you know, I've got a built-in fan base that come every week, no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm backing up a songwriter, whether I'm fronting my country band, and my like Ray Price style 50s country band, or whether I'm doing an old-time ensemble, or whatever it is I'm doing, these same people come out. And after the third time, a handful of them were really encouraging me to maybe look at making a record with this band. And I hadn't really thought about it, but it started to feel really great, and I started to write some new material for it. So, you know, in the String Dusters, it's like that's a five-way democracy, and there's a lot of strength in that, but it also means that there's a lot of compromise. And I'd never made a record that I could just do whatever I wanted. Mm-hmm. Literally whatever I wanted, whatever songs I wanted. I wrote the arrangements, got a lot of input from the band, and that really became the biggest and most important part of the process for me as I started making the record, was just to sort of see if I could kind of pursue my own sensibilities without a lot of concern for what other people thought. And additionally, since I'm already in the String Dusters, I'm not launching a solo career. I'm plenty busy with that band. I won't even get to really tour this record. It's not as though I'm like hanging my entire career on this project, you know, which gave me a lot of freedom. Whether people listen to it or not isn't as nearly as much consequence as it would be for most people who are making this kind of record. So that's sort of the story of how it came about, and the bass playing on there for the bass players is incredible. Mike Ashworth is just a wonderful and creative and incredibly musical bass player, and it was really an enjoyable experience for me to be able to just play the rhythm guitar and watch the rhythm section do their thing. I learned a lot through the process. It was really amazing.
Gotcha. Well, and I myself find very difficult to do two things at once. I guess I'm very simple-minded that way. So if I am singing, I can't be playing. But I could do rhythm guitar because, again, you're following a chordal pattern. And it fits more also with your melodic flow. Whereas with a bass, you may be counterpointing and doing more of a syncopated, different tempo thing. And I find anybody that can sing and play at the same time just to be, I'm in awe every time. Like, how can you do that, you know?
It really is a special skill. It's much easier for me when I'm playing like bluegrass and stuff that is not syncopated and straight ahead with the beat. Infinitely easier than trying to play, you know, funk or anything where there's, you know, the people, you know, I mean, it's there are bassists among us that are sort of playing. It's almost like they're playing with a different set of rules, different set of preconceptions, and they're almost a different type of human. And on the upright bass, like Edgar Meyer is a prime example of that. But the reason I thought of it was, you know, thinking in terms of like what Geddy Lee is able to do with the bass and the singing, and it's really remarkable. I think one of the things that makes it possible is when the bass lines are almost, they're locked in with the melody so that they work similarly together. But mm-hmm. trying to play two sort of counter-opposed rhythmic and melodic ideas simultaneously is, it's so hard and almost impossible. And so to your point, I mean, that it was really essential for me to have another bass player playing on this record so that I could focus on what I wanted to do, focus on singing and the chord voicings and the rhythm and the guitar sound that I heard in my head, and allow the bass player to really shine, you know, with no compromises.
Nice, nice. And with this album, especially with a title like Love and Other Strange Emotions, I'm taking that there's a cathartic part of also this expression for you as a songwriter and what you're sharing. And by putting it out there, so many times the listening public will identify with these very same kind of events in their life. They'll go, oh yeah, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
About this.
Yeah, well, a lot of times what makes great songs is that they express these sort of universal truths and universal experiences. And that's such a hard thing to capture as a songwriter. And I don't know whether I did it or not, but I do know that I found when I assembled the songs for this record that there was a lot of sort of wading into the sort of deep sea of emotional states and sort of the strangeness of all of it, you know, whether I'm feeling anxiety or whether I'm feeling, you know, love toward the situation or fear or all of these things. It's so, the whole phenomena of the unfolding and the arising and falling of emotions to me is just very strange mm-hmm. and kind of fascinating. But that's what so much music is. So much music is about that, you know, and about specifically about love, but also about a lot about fear. And ideally, hopefully, you know, we're expressing some of these universal truths, and that's why these things resonate. And I think to try to pin down what a song means only really serves to kind of shrink it mm-hmm. and reduce the potential impact. I think sort of like the more expansive perspective I can have on what these songs are about, the more possibility there is for people to find themselves in them.
Gotcha, gotcha. Well, and as if you weren't busy enough with the String Dusters and again, getting this album going, you also have a podcast, and I know you do performances with one of the other members of the String Dusters, one of the guitarists. Tell us, again, yet another gig. What?
Yeah. Yeah, I have a penchant for making things up and then coming up with ideas about what to do. And then the follow through is really the tricky part. You know, you put all this stuff on the calendar and then there's deadlines. But yeah, I started this podcast. It was basically just a variety show. We'd get online and live stream, and I'd have guests come in. It was during the pandemic when everyone was sitting at home. Mm-hmm. And I kind of realized coming out of that as things changed that it really worked to edit these conversations into the podcast format. So I've continued with that. And what really sets the podcast Travis Book Happy Hour apart is that these interviews are happening in front of a live audience, and there's also a musical collaborative element. That's an essential part of it, is that if you're going to come be on my show, we're going to play music together, you know? And that continues to be really fun and incredibly challenging. I learned so much, and I end up shedding a lot on things that I otherwise wouldn't, developing a lot of bass techniques that I otherwise might not if I wasn't sort of trying to be the consummate sideman once a month. And then, yeah, and then the guitar player of my band, he and I both love the music of Jerry Garcia, and we end up playing a lot of Jerry when we're just hanging out and jamming. And so we've started taking the show on the road, and we basically have like a two-person acoustic tribute to Jerry Garcia where we play music from the entire catalog of Jerry and try to just celebrate that music because it means a lot to a lot of people, and Jerry's not around to play it anymore, and we just love doing it. So yeah, Falco and Book play Jerry Garcia is, you know, we wear these tie-dye suits. The joke is it's like two dads, it's two tie-dye suits and a minivan, you know, and we just cruise around and have a good time and play this music we love.
Yeah, whenever I see fabric like that, I'm always thinking that there's some factory somewhere where they must be laughing their asses off putting this together going, who's going to wear this? Ah, ha, ha.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's the most popular suit that they sell.
There you go. There you go. Well, and with all of this, you've got lots of ways that you're getting your sound because you're a vocalist, because you're a writer, but bass-wise, I know a lot of us like to kind of know how you're getting your sound. with double bass, as we previously mentioned, most double bass players I know will have like their one that they love, and there's about as much room as they have for it. You know? Yeah.
Well, I'm lucky. My mom bought the house across the street, and it's a little bit bigger than mine. So if I end up with more basses than I can handle, I just put them over there in the corner of her house. It is a balancing act because it's like a giant piece of furniture in mm-hmm. the corner. But it's sort of the same thing with amplifiers. I mean, I've got a big stack of amps here too, and I don't want to get rid of any of them, but I don't really need... I'm looking around my office, like there's instruments. I mean, there's just instruments everywhere, you know. The guitar rack is full, and the wall is full, and, you know, and then the bass is over here in the corner.
There you go.
So, yeah, we try to fit it all in. You know, I've been playing basses by Upton.
Okay.
Which they make great American-made basses, Gary and his crew, up in Stonington, Connecticut. I've been playing those for probably 15 years, and I've had like four or five of them. We've developed this really cool thing. It's a upright bass that fits in a suitcase.
Nice.
And it's 13 pieces that unbolt or bolt together depending on which way you're going. They all nest inside of each other and fit inside of a suitcase, which makes travel really easy. Really interesting concept. The bass I've got right now is just a solid top with a laminate side and back and a flat back. I really like the flat back bass for a lot of reasons. I feel like it's the sound comes out of it a little quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as my pedals and that kind of thing, my pedal board is for the Dusters is relatively simple because I'm okay with having a fairly fundamental and basic upright bass tone. A lot of the other guys in the band have these massive pedal boards and they've got all kinds of effects and that sort of thing. I do use one. I use a Rupert Neve tube preamp, and then we have a sound guy who travels with us on tour. So if I didn't have a sound guy, I would probably invest a little bit more in what I was sending from the XLR cable out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was going on in front of me. But I know with whatever I've got, if I send it through that preamp and it goes to our engineer, he's got a great ear and he manipulates that sound. One thing he did, though, get for me is an EQ pedal that I specifically click on for when I go, when I switch to Arco and start to bow.
Nice.
Because the instrument responds so much differently. It's louder and the EQ needs are different. So that's something that I've added in the last few years that I'll probably never go without. That transition, it's hard to go full. For me, it's hard to play sort of full with the fingers and then also play full with the bow and have those sounds mesh without a pedal to sort of switch the EQ.
Gotcha.
So that's been a big development in my onstage sound.
Very cool. Very cool. And as we look forward, I know, again, you've got a busy docket, tour dates both with the String Dusters and some with the album as well. Tell us a little bit about those.
2024 it's just like a tapestry or a quilt of all these things sort of fitting together. Dusters are doing New Year's, and then I go up to Canada to actually do this thing called Heligrass, where we play music and go heli skiing, which is very cool. And that's when that 13-piece bass will come in handy for all that travel up there. I have a few dates with my own band, the essentially sort of like the Travis Book band. We're playing a couple festivals in the spring. But that band is, because the players are so heavy and a lot of them are really busy touring musicians, it's hard to get that band together. That's partly why I do every Tuesday at this local venue, 185 King Street, because I know there are a surprising number of heavy musicians where I live. I live in a little town about 45 minutes outside of Asheville in North Carolina.
Okay.
And I know that I can almost always get them on a Tuesday, you know, unless they're out for like a multi-week tour. A lot of my friends, you know, their musicians have been around for a long time, playing for a long time, and they've got families, and so they'll go out for the weekends, but they're always around on Tuesdays. And so the Tuesday lineup, musically, that's really where I get to stretch my legs, and that just changes constantly. So, yeah, some Travis Book band dates, a lot of Travis Book and Friends dates, and then some duo dates, doing a little bit of Jerry Garcia in the South and in Colorado. But the String Dusters have a huge summer festival schedule this summer. That's what we mostly do, and that's really what our band is really great at, is fitting on the bill in a lot of different kinds of festivals, being sort of a progressive jamgrass, bluegrass, neo-folk Americana band means that, you know, we can headline a traditional bluegrass festival, and it's like a little more lights and sound than they may be used to, but we can fit in there. We can play, you know, we can go up to Newport Folk Festival and fit into the folk scene. We can also go to, you know, like High Sierra or other jam band festivals and find a home there. So we've been really fortunate. The String Duster sound is, we have a lot of singers, and it can't really be pinned necessarily straight to any genre, but it does mean that it fits in a lot of festival lineups, and we're really grateful for that, for the opportunity to go to festivals, because that's really about my favorite place to play.
Nice. Well, and if people want to know where to find you, where's the best place for them to look?
I got my website, thetravisbook.com. I'm also on Instagram. It's just my name, Travis Book. I'd like to joke, you know you're old if you have your own name on Instagram.
You got it before somebody else did.
I got there first. That's kind of the best. That's the best place. And my record's on Spotify or wherever else you listen to music, whatever you're into. I have no judgment. Apple Music, whatever. The new record's out there, and everything that we're putting out. You know, I've got a compilation of all the guests I've had on the Happy Hour. That's out there too. The Jerry Duo has got a really cool live record, and the dynamic of that music with just upright bass and guitar, I think, is really special. We'll put out another volume of that, and there's more String Dusters records too coming in the next year. I think we're going to put out two or three records this next year. So, thetravisbook.com, thestringdusters.com, and on tour with the Dusters, or every Tuesday in Brevard, North Carolina at 185 King Street. I'm there playing music with my friends. So those are all the best places to track me down.
Excellent. Well, Travis, we appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule to chat with us, and of course, wish you much continued success. Folks, you've seen him here, Travis Book, on Bass Musician Magazine.
Thanks, Ralph.